Okay, well, thanks for inviting me. It's my first time in Ontario ever, so it's an adventure. And I'll be talking about very light Axie gluons and the top asymmetry, although the title should probably be the other way around, since I'll survey the experimental landscape first and then talk about what other models are out there. What did I do here? Okay. So first I'll talk a little bit about why we care about a top quark asymmetry. There are all sorts of other asymmetries with other particles, but of course the top quark is special, and everybody knows that, everybody tells you that, so we're not going to belabor that point. I'll talk a little bit about forward-backward asymmetries in general, what those are good for, how they've been used in the past, and what's at stake this time around. I'll talk about the CDF and D0 anomalies, what they've measured, and why that matters. If we interpret those anomalies as new physics, it's good to know what kind of new physics is needed, what are the constraints, and what are the model-building challenges. And there are a few common ones that seem to plague a lot of explanations that people have tried to throw on the wall. Then after that's settled, talk a little bit about why very light Axie gluons are interesting, and of course, what you're asking, you know, why aren't they ruled out? And I'm thinking of Axie gluons that are below the top threshold. And so we're going to look at a slightly unorthodox model for this. So first and foremost, the top quark is the heaviest particle. It feels electroweak symmetry breaking the most strongly, and so we'd like to know all of its properties. Compared to a lot of other particles out there, it's relatively unknown. It's a possible portal for physics beyond the standard model if we believe that the dynamics giving it mass, or perhaps not just the standard model Higgs. If there's something more out there, then perhaps the top quark could help shed light on what's beyond the frontier. And of course, it's an obvious target for present and future precision measurements. We're starting to see that now as the Tevatron and LHC have accumulated enough data to probe it. Top quark's also got the curious property that it decays well before it has time to hadronize on account of its width compared to the scale of hadronization in QCD. And that means that when the tops decay in a pair production process like we have here, it tends to preserve, or the final state decay products tend to preserve the partonic spin information, and that gives you a handle on some of the production kinematics that you wouldn't otherwise be able to have if other kinds of strongly interacting particles are produced at a collider. The top almost always decays to WB more than 99% of the time, and so the kinds of experimental final states we're going to have involve 6, 4, and 2 jets, and we'll be looking at cases where we have 2 and 4 for the measurements that have been made so far. A forward-backward asymmetry in general, if you've got a 2-to-2 scattering process, you can define it as the difference of the forward and backward cross-sections divided by their sum, where in the simplest possible case, you just define forward and backward as the partial integrals over the differential rate. If you have an asymmetric initial state, then you can just define a forward direction, say, in the direction of the incoming proton as opposed to the antiproton if you've got a PP bar collision. And this is interesting because it can be sensitive to new intermediate states that you might not be able to produce on shell. And this was interesting historically. It gave us some of the first hints of the Z boson in looking at E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus collisions. If those collisions only give rise to mu plus mu minus through a photon, you'd get different final state kinematics than you would if, say, there were other particles like a Z boson. And so it's interesting to apply this kind of analysis to something like a top quark, which we don't really know very much about and which could harbor lots more information about new physics. At the Tevatron, you're ideally suited to make this kind of measurement because your initial state is not identical. You've got a definite forward direction. It's not as true at the Tevatron, but there are ways to get around that, and we'll discuss those a little bit, but that's not the main focus of the talk. So what does QCD have to tell us about a forward-backward asymmetry? In QCD, at tree level, everything's nice and symmetric. There's no issue, but once you go up to next to leading order, you do end up with a small asymmetry that was calculated some 10 years ago. It's about 5%, although Kirill Melnikov tells me that it's actually more like 7 or 8%, depending on how you do it. Either way, it's a pretty small effect that's significantly smaller than what either of the Tevatron experiments are seeing so far. The reason you end up with any sort of asymmetry in QCD is that the diagrams that you have at next to leading order aren't charge symmetric in the final state with respect to Q and Q bar, and so you end up something you end up with something at the percent level. So when CDF tried to measure this, in January they released a paper with the lepton plus jets final state topology, where one of the tops gives rise to a W and B, gives you leptons, the other one gives you nothing but hadrons, and they defined a related AFB variable in terms of the rapidity differences of the top and the anti-top. The one somewhat controversial aspect of their analysis is that even though they observe raw data, they see leptons, jets, missing energy, the usual stuff that you might get in a final state in a hadron collider, they have a deconvolution algorithm that takes all of that raw data, it deconvolves it using their known detector, jet, branching algorithms. And this is used to reconstruct TT bar kinematics. They report information about tops themselves, and this allows them to be able to tell you exactly what the rapidity difference was between the two partons that you produced at the level of the matrix element. That part is somewhat controversial, but there are good reasons to think that this data is trustworthy. And we'll get to those in a little bit. But the total inclusive partonic asymmetry, if you just add up all the top events that go in the direction of the initial proton's momentum, and you subtract off the number of events where the final state top quark is in the opposite direction, you end up with something that's of order 16%. But if you bin this result, so this is only at the inclusive level, this is what we ought to compare up against the QCD prediction of about 5%. This is only about a 2-point-something sigma excess, by itself not too significant. But if you bin the asymmetry, you'll notice that at about 450 GeV, it not only changes signs, but then goes way up. Yes, sir? In this case, the answer why depends on whether or not you think it's new physics. I mean, if it's new physics, then we'll see some new physics explanations that naturally have this feature, so we'll get to that in a few slides. But it has to do with the fact that in many of these models, you're looking at interference diagrams between standard model and new physics, and those generically have the feature that they're proportional to Mandelstam S minus some new mass squared. And so for lower masses, the mass is just bigger than S, and so you're down here. But then as you get higher and higher Mandelstam S, then you get a much larger asymmetry. And that's just what you get when you do the calculation.
Part of the question is it a priori or not, right?
Yeah.
Like, did they a priori choose 450?
I think they did, but I'm not sure. So this is the most controversial part of these asymmetry measurements at the Tevatron. D0 doesn't get the same kind of mass dependence, and we'll see that on a later slide. For my purposes, I'm just going to look at the inclusive asymmetry in both cases where they do agree. You're right that this is controversial. The binning here is also not standard. So here, the binning is about 50 GeV, whereas out here, it gets to be about 100. So that's a fair point to raise, and I don't have anything more to say about this mass dependence. I'll let them hash it out because they don't agree on this anyway. It's possible, but then, I mean, at the very least, they could have chosen a more consistent binning. You could have that same effect if you didn't decide to break this down into two small parts. But at any rate, it's suggestive of new physics. CDF also did and before I get to that, one major constraint for any sort of new physics explanation is that the same data gives you the appropriate TT bar invariant mass distribution without any significant discrepancies from the standard model prediction. It looks the way that the standard model tells you, and you get the right number, about 7 picobarns. And it's difficult for generic new physics to increase AFB without also distorting this in some sort of noticeable way. CDF did a dilepton measurement too, where you have both of the W's produced from top decays go to leptons. This inclusive asymmetry is even larger. It's about 40%. This so far is only at the level of a public note. They haven't written any sort of papers about this. They do unfolding, presumably the same kind of unfolding, but since it's only a public note, we don't have the same level of detailed information that we would in a paper. It's consistent with the inclusive result from the lepton plus jet search at the 2-sigma level, but their mass dependence is a lot flatter, and so maybe that's another reason to doubt what they've been seeing in the lepton plus jets channel. D0 did a complementary measurement in the lepton plus jets channel. They haven't done a dilepton one yet, but I know for a fact that they're going to release that one in a matter of months. Here it's roughly the same data set, 5.4 inverse femtobarns. Their inclusive asymmetry is about 20%. So we're starting to see something that across a lot of different channels at different experiments gives you about a 20% asymmetry at greater than 2-sigma confidence. This is potentially new physics. If you only look at the inclusive asymmetry and you disregard the fact that the D0 result is a lot flatter when you look at the mass dependence. That part still remains controversial, but when you combine them all, if you trust that they're doing all of their inclusive measurements correctly, then it's way more than 3-sigma significance relative to the standard model prediction. So the most aberrant single measurement is the mass dependence. D0 doesn't see it. CDF only sees it in one channel. Whether or not we take that seriously is still up in the air. We're going to need more data and more analyses from the two collaborations. But for that purpose, I'm going to ignore that for the rest of this talk. I'm only going to look at the inclusive asymmetries as far as model building goes. Individually, when you, all three of them are seeing something that's consistent. They're all seeing positive asymmetries. They're all more than 2-sigma, and in some cases more than 3-sigma. And if you combine them, they are well above 3-sigma compared to the standard model. For the rest of this talk, we're going to interpret that as new physics. And of course, this is only based on half of the total data set. So even with regard to these first three measurements, we're going to get a doubling in the next few months. And so we're going to have a lot more insight down the road. And of course, this could all be crap. We don't really know whether the standard model predicts exactly an asymmetry of about 5%. That's somewhat controversial. The experiments themselves haven't combined these results. This is just an interpretation. This is my disclaimer slide. There's some controversy over the unfolding procedure. CDF and D0 don't exactly agree on this. They each think that the other one does it slightly wrong. I'm not an expert on those details. D0 especially doesn't like the way that they've done the invariant mass dependence over at CDF. But what's interesting is that if you look at the D0 result, and if you ignore all of the unfolding, you ignore the stuff that gives you parton level information, you just look at a slightly different asymmetry distribution. You look at the lepton asymmetry from the one lepton in the lepton plus jets topology, and you ask what its rapidity is, and you bin that. It turns out that that gives you a more than 3-sigma excess over the standard model prediction, and that doesn't involve any unfolding. So I would say that's trustworthy to some degree. This could also just be a systematic problem. They have similar detectors. This hasn't been ruled out as a potential explanation. Higher order QCD calculations may give a bigger standard model asymmetry because since this phenomenon only arises at the loop level anyway, to get a next to leading order QCD prediction, you have to do a next to next to leading order calculation, which is tricky. And I don't think anyone's been able to do that completely yet. There have been some partial results and the status is unclear, but most people do not expect the overall asymmetry inclusive to rise significantly higher than 5%. So the working strategy from this point forward is to interpret the combined inclusive result as new physics, and then think about the model building challenges while we wait for more data from both the Tevatron and the LHC. So what do we need? If we're going to interpret this as new physics, we're going to have to preserve the total TT bar production cross section. And this is hard if you do it with an S-channel mediator, because then naively, if you're going to have something that gives you TT bar production, it'll also give you lighter quark production, and that means you suffer from constraints at diejet searches, diejet resonance searches. especially if you've got a very narrow width that would give you a sharp resonance at a search like this. So one possibility is to do it with a neutral T-channel exchange. You also have to interfere with the standard model gluon exchange diagrams, where you have QQ bar go to TT bar. Now, this isn't a strict requirement, but without interference, it's sort of hard to imagine how this sort of phenomenon could occur, because you need something that's of order 20% to explain the asymmetry. The standard model only gives you a tiny contribution to that. And so if you're not interfering, then the new physics squared diagrams have to give you the total asymmetry, but then you're squaring those, and so they just give you an additive contribution to the total cross-section. And so without interference, you're just automatically increasing the rate quite a lot, and it's not clear that doing so would be allowed, given that the cross-section's been measured very well. And if you do interfere, if that's the strategy, then the new particle has to be a color octet if you're going through the S channel, just to make sure that the quantum numbers going in and coming out are the same. And it's got to be a color singlet if it's going to be something T channel. Natural candidates for this are going to be some sort of massive gluon if you're going through the S, or a Z prime, or possibly a W prime if you're going through the T. There are more exotic possibilities, but I'd say these are sort of the benchmark models that people have thrown out. If you do it with a Z prime, the T-channel kinematics are what give you the asymmetry, and you're not going through a resonance, so you're not significantly increasing TT-bar production. Here, the effective operator that we're writing down is, well, it's a nice for normalizable operator, but it's kind of ugly in the sense that you have to pick arbitrary couplings to the left and right-hand parts of the quarks, and it has to be flavor violating because you're starting off with stuff that lives in the proton, and you're producing the third generation through a T exchange, so you're forced into flavor changing neutral currents. But you do get an asymmetry. You also have to be leptophobic if you're going to avoid lep constraints, and it predicts lots of single top events, since you can take this diagram and look at it going up, and instead of having, say, a T bar, you could have another lighter quark, since you're predicting a lot of flavor violation, and so you end up with a single top event. And now we've got some sharp constraints on those too. You get strong bounds from flavor. You play with flavor, you play with fire, and so the couplings that you have up here have to be pretty unnatural. They're of order 10 to the minus 4 if you're looking at things that are close to the weak scale.
Well, that depends on the detailed flavor structure of the couplings, right?
Absolutely. But this is just to give an idea of,
you know. And if you throw something random down.
So you could look at it through the S channel instead. Imagine a similar sort of coupling, only in this case, rather than having a Z prime, you have like a gluon prime, where you're coupling G prime to QQ bar. This has to be a color octet to get the right quantum numbers for the asymmetry, and we can parameterize it in a similar way with FLs and FRs for the first and second generations, and we can do GLs and GRs for the third generation, coupling to TT bar. And of course, we insert the appropriate projection operators to make sure it's all nice and cool. If we write down the partonic cross-section as a sum of standard model, interference, and new physics squared terms, we end up with an expression that looks like this for the interference term. And this is what gives you most of your asymmetry. So the quartic piece in all of this is going to be suppressed by your coupling raised to the fourth power. By alpha to the fourth power. But the interference term is where you run into certain problems. So for a generic heavy gluon, where you've got left and right-handed couplings, then what you'll notice is that you have terms here that are proportional to even powers of the scattering angle in the center of mass frame. So here you've got a cosine squared piece, and here you have a linear piece. And this is only true if you've got these generic couplings that involve PLs and P-rights in some sort of anarchic way. The asymmetry comes entirely from the piece that's linear in cosine theta. And this is an intriguing piece because it has the feature that when you integrate it over the full range of scattering angles, that term disappears. So it doesn't actually contribute to your cross-section, but it contributes to your asymmetry. And so that's a feature that people like to exploit when they write down axigluon models. You pick FL to be minus FR, and the other two terms drop out, but this term survives. One complication in all of this is that, as was alluded to earlier, is that this interference term that gives you the asymmetry is proportional to S hat minus mg squared, And that means that for a completely stupid reason, the asymmetry comes out negative. That if you have flavor universality here, you're squaring the coupling, so no matter what sign you choose, that turns out to be positive. Here, you're going to have s hat minus m squared, and if you're going to avoid diegetic resonance constraints, m has to be bigger than most s hat values, and therefore you're going to have a negative asymmetry. That disagrees with what CDF and D0 have observed. And so the way people get around this is by assuming that this combination of couplings is less than zero, which forces you into flavor violation. And that, of course, gives you some other flavor constraints. And so let's consider a slightly modified version of this idea. Let's look at a very light Axie gluon where you're doing something similar. You're enlarging the strong sector in the UV. You break it down to QCD by some mechanism that I'm not going to specify just yet. The only requirement is that the IR Lagrangian has an Axie gluon-like coupling to Q and Q bar. We're going to assume that it's totally flavor diagonal, and we have to if it's going to be light. If it's going to be light, you're going to have lots of KK bar mixing, and that's going to be ruled out right off the bat. And one thing that we're also going to do is take G prime, the coupling of this operator, and we're going to dial it down. We're going to say it's in units of the strong coupling, it's going to be some lambda where lambda is less than 1, and in most interesting cases, much, much less than 1 if we want to stay alive. We're going to have Axie gluons. They're going to be an octet, so whatever breaking scheme we set up in the UV has to give rise to 8 of these, and they have to be less than 2m top. And so what do we get when we do this? I'll first talk about the virtues, and then I'll talk about the problems. The virtue is that when you write down the same kind of differential cross-section, now your interference term looks like this. If you're very light, and m squared is much, much less than m s hat, you solve that problem. You're not required to have flavor violation anymore. And now you can just have a common factor of lambda for every quark coupling. The interference term goes like lambda squared and cosine theta. And so when you integrate over the whole angular range, this doesn't contribute to the total cross section. And it gives you the right sign right away. Doesn't contribute to the cross section. And when you look at the new physics squared term, that term is going to be order lambda to the fourth. And so the correction to the total cross section is tiny. It ends up being roughly a few percent, which is totally fine given the error bars measured at CDF and D0. Similar story applies to the LHC. So what happens when you look at the TT bar invariant mass distribution? This is straightforward simulation using fine rules to implement the model, pass it through MadGraph to get the partonic events, then send it over to Pithy and PGS to do the parton shower and the detector simulation. If you look at MTT bar, since we're below resonance, this for an 80 GeV MG prime with a dial-down coupling where lambda is 0.3, you see no evidence of any sort of resonant structure. And this makes sense. If you add up all these events, you're really only modifying this the total production rate by a few percent. Here, the pink histograms were just taken from CDF's background study. To that, we add on the standard model contribution and the Axie gluon contribution. And this plot includes all of it. And this is compared up against CDF data from the Lepton plus JET search. I think that's all I want to say with this slide. But of course, we've got a lot of experimental bounds. So that's what's nice about it. And you might look at old UA2 diget searches and wonder, well, how was this all missed? You know, Axie gluons only decay to jet pairs. And so you could look at a diget resonance search. The LHC's ruled out digets for a wide range of parameters. And I think now the current bound is somewhere in the TV range, several TV, I think. But the Tevatron and LHC only look for diget resonances above about 200 GeV. The lowest I've seen is in the 100 GeV range coming from those two colliders. UA2 is the strongest constraint here. And here's a paper that UA2 put out in 1991 where they scanned the MJJ range from about 50 to, well, they went further, but here it's only out to 120 GeV. And this was an attempt to measure the width, the combined widths of W and Z using only calorimetry. This was the first time anyone attempted to do this measurement. And what they found agreed with the standard model. But it did so in a way that gave them a huge upward fluctuation. And looking at this plot, it looks pretty bad. You see this bump, and it's a bump right around where you expect a W and Z to live, and you don't see anything in this lower region, and so you wonder how anything that couples with anything close to GS in this mass range could possibly be allowed. One part of the answer is that if you look at the signal here, the standard model prediction is about 5.8 nanobarns, and now we're in nanobarn territory. Sigma times branching, as they've extracted in this plot, is about 9.6. And so there's a lot of room to maneuver. You can pretty much double this thing and still be consistent out to the statistical error bars. The other complication in all of this is that their background model is totally empirical. They use a falling exponential with a die Gaussian that's been situated around 100, or that's been situated around 80 and 90 GeV. The one thing to keep in mind about this plot is that the normalization is very deceptive. Here, where we see the y-axis with numbers like 4,000, that's after you've rescaled them by a factor of mjj over 100 raised to the sixth power. Let's look at the same data once you correct for that and just look at dn, dmjj. When you do that, this is what the data actually tells you. And if you take this data and you apply a background model that just has a falling exponential with a die Gaussian peak, say, in the neighborhood where you expect a W and Z to live, there's no way that eyeballing this you could tell that there's new physics lurking or that there isn't any new physics lurking. In fact, the W and Z live right here. So if you didn't know to look for them and do that rescaling procedure that puts the die Gaussian right in this neighborhood, you'd never eyeball this and say, oh, look, I have a resonance in this neighborhood. You'd look at this and you'd say, it's a falling exponential, the background's too large. Only after you put the die Gaussian on there do you end up with a signal in this neighborhood where the signal to background is under a single percent. And that gets worse as you get into the lower range here. And so if you want to use this data to constrain something in this neighborhood, you have to use a dedicated new physics search. You have to have a tri-Gaussian or maybe something optimized for a lower range where you're not picking up contributions from W and Z. From here on out, what I'm going to do is consider only the constraint that arises from the statistical error bars that they have from their extraction. And so I don't exactly know what the proper background model for this thing ought to be. They used something that was normalized to the data. What we can do in the region between 80 and 100 GeV is take their die Gaussian. This is the cross-section that you'd extract for the W and the Z that lives only under the die Gaussian. This is the best fit after they've fit the rest of the data. If you saturate the statistical error bars at 2 sigma, and you take the difference between the standard model and the observed result, that's the room that you have left to maneuver with. And in the region below that, the only thing you have to work with are Poisson errors. And so if you can satisfy Poisson errors in this region, and you can live within the constraints of their measurement out to 2 sigma in the region where you expect the W and the Z to live, then you can actually survive this constraint. It constrains the model, and it kills some of the parameter space, but there's enough left over to give you some non-trivial TT-bar asymmetry. What other bounds are there? Well, at a lepton collider, you're not going to be able to produce this directly, but if E plus and E minus fuse into a Z, then you can get an axi gluon to radiate off of 2 quarks at the Z pole. And the Z pole is very well measured, very well studied. So if you look at the hadronic width of the Z, it's known and agrees with the standard model out to within a fraction of a percent, 0.1%. The expression that you end up with when you consider the theoretical correction due to an axi gluon looks a lot like this. There's one mistake on this slide. There should have been a factor of lambda squared here. So this is the correction, the leading correction due to QCD. You put lambda squared here, and that would be the leading correction due to the presence of an axi gluon. And what we want to make sure is that at 95% confidence, the fractional correction due to the width proportional to this additional factor, including the lambda squared, doesn't exceed 2.3 times 10 to the minus 3. And it turns out we can also do this, but here it's a little trickier. It's trickier because the way that you apply this constraint depends to some extent on what assumptions you make about alpha Z or alpha S at the Z pole. Alpha S at the Z pole is extracted using the hadronic width of the Z, and The conventional way of doing this involves taking a standard model expression, including higher order QCD corrections, and then extracting alpha s using that. If you have new physics in the final state, then you're going to be adding new terms to this, and those terms are going to look a lot like gluons, they're going to look a lot like QCD, and so the generic expectation is that you're decreasing alpha s at mz as a result of this new physics, and that also opens up a little bit of parameter space. Turns out that that's going to be very sensitive to how it's extracted. It's very sensitive to exactly what parameters you choose and how much of an effect you have on the running. And so I'll consider a lot of different scenarios for what constraints apply. And so the value at the z-pole is taken to be 0.1184. We're going to decrease that slightly, but we'll also look at bounds where it hasn't been decreased at all. And we can just leave it at that. Before we get to the main plot, there are a few other constraints to consider. So there's a Tevatron 3B jet search. It was designed to study Higgs decays in the MSSM, where they look for dijet resonances in 3B events. That one started at about 100 GeV, so it's going to be safe for smaller dijet masses. I won't consider anything larger than 100 GeV just to be on the safe side in this. But there's a bound from below, too. And it comes from a paper from Kaplan and Schwartz in 2008 where they looked at jet observables at LEP, and they looked at distributions like thrust, and they tried to look for threshold corrections due to potential new physics states. And they analyzed, they did a scan and found that the lower bound was roughly about 50 GeV for a particle that couples like a gluino. And so you've got a color octet fermion that doesn't couple to quarks. This is a model-dependent search. They did it for an arbitrary number of degrees of freedom. So the gluino in this case would have two, but you could have an arbitrary number that you extract using their analysis. But they didn't consider any couplings to quarks. And so presumably that would increase, or that would make the bound a lot stronger. But then again, if you've got an axigluon, that couples with a gamma 5. So perhaps there's room for some cancellations between possible contributions to these distributions. I'm not sure exactly what the situation is, and this would have to be reanalyzed in the context of more permissive assumptions. But to be on the safe side, we're certainly not going to consider anything that's less than 50 GeV. And so this is roughly where we live. So out here, you're dealing with the 3B search and possible constraints from dijet resonance searches at the Tevatron and the LHC. If you're to the left of this plot, or actually to the left of about 50, which is on this plot, then you're ruled out by the Kaplan-Schwartz analysis. And here's what's left. The purple region in the middle, the dark purple, is the one sigma favored region for the combined CDF and D0 inclusive asymmetry measurement. The pink bands on the two sides of that are the two sigma favored regions. UA2 constrains you along this line, in that the region above this is ruled out. And the bounds from the hadronic width of the Z are these black lines, each one assuming a slightly different reduction in the value of alpha S at MZ, depending on what parameters your axigluon has. Since it's really sensitive to this, I just leave it as three different possible assumptions you could make about what effect this has. If you just do it with the LEP constraint, assuming that alpha is completely unaffected, then you've got a small region to play with. If it's affected at the 2% level, then you can perhaps probe into the one sigma favored region. And if you're reducing it by about 5%, then you can probe the one sigma favored region. If you're below all the lines, you're totally safe. And it turns out that if you just do a back-of-the-envelope calculation, you go into the PDG, and you look at how well alpha strong's been measured at various energies, you could do something that's reasonably conservative. You can look at a value of alpha s at very, very low energies, something from mesonic physics. And then you can run it down into higher values, taking into account the axigluon corrections just at leading order in the beta function. And it turns out that the generic effect you have is of order a couple of percent. It's very sensitive to which initial condition you choose, and it's very sensitive to how many higher order effects you add. And so where the actual bound lies depends on a very, very thorough calculation, doing precisely all of those things and doing them more carefully than I could. And so I leave it at this. It's sensitive to exactly how you extract it. But it's not as hopeless as one might naively think, just looking at it. And so in conclusion, the forward-backward asymmetry may be evidence of new physics, and we'll certainly get a better idea of what's out there from the LHC and from later analyses coming out of the Tevatron. Most models require particles that violate flavor, and in some cases very badly, and they require you to live out at a few TeV. That's usually to get around either constraints from the top cross-section or from digit resonances. If you have a flavor universal axi gluon in this choice mass range, where you're living under all of those lines, then you can get a large enough asymmetry to make a dent in what the standard model is observing. If instead of taking the CDF benchmark standard model prediction of 5%, and you do what some other people have suggested and replace that with 8%, then it gets slightly better. At any rate, this is, to my knowledge, the only way to do it without violating flavor. Contributions to the top cross-section are suppressed because you're only getting an asymmetry from the interference term, and the new physics squared contribution to the total cross-section falls off like lambda to the fourth, which is completely negligible and at most adds a percent level correction to sigma TT bar. The parameter space for AFB in this model is not very large, but it's very sensitive to exactly how we get alpha S in the context of a new physics scenario. And that's the magnitude of this effect is still an open question, but it's very meaningful for a model like this because we see how much those lines change even if you only modify the extracted value at the percent level. It may also be possible to revisit the low MJJ region with a dedicated search if the data is still available, just to do a tri-Gaussian fit or to do what they did with W and Z, but to do it with lower MJJs, or to just do it in a slightly more generic way where you don't exactly know where to look. And that would be able to give you some sort of handle. As far as I know, a lot of the same observables would also apply to the LHC, so the things that people have done looking at heavier axi gluons with slightly modified observables to probe the same underlying physics should also apply to this model. And so at this point, the best way to distinguish this from any other potential explanation would be to look at older LEP bounds, maybe do a bump hunt in four-jet events at LEP and see if a resonance can be extracted. But until then, we're just going to have to wait and see what the LHC tells us. Thanks. That's it.
Any questions?
So can you go back to the previous slide?
Yeah.
Just to get intuition, so that yellow line, you say at least around 80, 90 GeV, that's where it would roughly equal the W and Z cross-section?
This is roughly where the contribution from axi gluons, including acceptance effects and everything else, would actually be a little more than that, because their central value was almost twice the standard model prediction, and then you take that out to 2 sigma, then it's slightly larger.
Okay.
It's slightly larger, but that's also assuming that they understand their background in that region, and so that's based entirely on the empirical fit that they have to the data.
Right. Well, so now I have to put on my my person who's done high statistics resonance searches hat.
Yep.
And you know, this argument about, oh well, if you plot it all on a, you know, on a linear scale where the where you can't even see the error bars, then you can't see the bump by eye. Well, that doesn't prove anything. There's a lot of cases where you do have statistical sensitivity mm-hmm. without any assumptions about the background and don't see the bump. So I think
well, in this case,
I appreciate your comment that it depends a lot on how they modeled the background mm-hmm. for the W and Z measurement, but you know.
Well, sorry, in this case in particular, sorry, I mean, if they're not using Monte Carlo and they're doing some energy smearing mm-hmm. business, then it's totally, I mean, it doesn't, the fact that it's hard to see on a sharp scale doesn't matter. They can transform the data however they'd like because they're just using an interpolating fit. Largely.
Right, they are.
Yeah, so that's totally.
Now, one can ask is you go back to the plot where they see the W and Z.
Yeah.
Where the underlying shape is coming from. There.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what the what's the
like?
You mean the shape for the background or for the bump?
For the background.
the background. They tried a number of different fits. They ended up with some function that was proportional to an exponential, but I don't remember the exact form. And sure, I'm not indicting their analysis in any of this.
But
and
I'm just saying, you could probably use even, I mean,
yeah,
the
and
analysis is probably pretty constraining for even just this analysis for 120 GeV resonance.
Actually, I have a related question.
Yeah.
So even in run one, the Tevatron didn't look down here to look for WZ and JetJet?
No. The only DiJet resonance searches that probed this region to look for this were at UA2.
Even to study WZ? Sorry, I'm just surprised. Do you know why?
I'm not sure. But there was a really good review on DiJet resonance searches that came out, I think, about a month ago, where they gave a list of every single possible DiJet resonance search at every possible collider, and they gave you the range associated with each one. And the only one that dipped down below, I think, about 120 GeV was UA2.
Now, there is the, there is the famous precursor of the WJetJet analysis, right? The WW and WZ analysis, where one W was decayed leptonically, the other one.
Mm-hmm.
You could also have W axigluon associated production with roughly the same kind of,
You could, but that associated production would have to come off of a quark line, and in that case, you're going to be suppressed by powers of lambda squared.
WW is also coming off of two quark lines.
That's true.
Right.
That's true.
So it's parametrically, the ratio of axigluon signal to W signal should be about the same as in the UA2 analysis, I think.
That sounds right.
A G axigluon squared times 8 colors over G2 times 3 polarization.
Yeah.
Squared.
That sounds about right.
And then the numerical factors matter in terms of. So have you looked at that as a constraint?
I haven't looked at that, but I will.
Okay.
Yeah. But just to get back to the issue of whether or not this data is constraining, and it is, for sure. So if you look at this spectrum, you can take all of these data points going all the way down into the very low MJJ region, and then you can just do Poisson statistics on these. And you can ask, well, in these regions, if I place a signal on top of that data, is it noticeable given the two sigma Poisson errors in each bin? And when you do that, it still leaves a fair bit of room that's covered in this line.
Right. Well, sorry. I mean, you're saying below 70, there's basically no bound.
I'm saying below 70, it's not as reliable as the...
much weaker.
Right. And at this point, that's not even the strongest bound beyond that point. But yeah, I mean, if it turns out to be continuous, it does extend that way. It's a lot sloppier way of doing it.
If you had underestimated the constraints by a factor of two, say,
mm-hmm.
then this would be a really big deal. It would be one of certainly not maybe not numerically the strongest, but because of the alpha S uncertainty, the most robust bound.
Yeah.
And close to the and would be enough to rule out the one sigma region.
That's true.
Right. So, I mean, I guess. So there's a little sliver of one sigma that's allowed if you take the UA2 line seriously and the 0.95 seriously?
Yes, it would be this region,
right.
Yeah.
And how much of that survives depends on whether the UA2 bound can secretly be any tighter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is possible that the line curves back down this way, for sure.
Sorry, the UA2 plot. What's the just out of curiosity? What was the width of your axigluon decay again?
The width is slightly under a GeV.
Much smaller than the resolution of the.
Yeah.
Quote what they
oh call. Yeah. I mean, their resolution. In
the
fact, actually.
Yeah.
Actually, a related thing is that. The numbers they have here, this was something that I didn't bring up earlier, but the 9.6 figure they get, the one that I'm constraining myself to, is based on them having imposed the lepton plus jets extraction of the W and Z width on this shape. And so they get 9.6 once they add additional information about the known widths for W and Z. If you don't do that, then it actually goes all the way up to about 12. But that's something that I hadn't considered. This is roughly what their resolution is, and it's pretty bad. It's a great analysis because this is the first time anyone was ever able to do this just using calorimetry. But for this kind of constraint, it's not as devastating as it first looks, just eyeballing that plot.
Do you know what A, B, and C correspond to?
They're all the same data. They're just modeled with, I think, either different background curves. That's right. It's all exactly the same data. They're just different. Different best fits. I forget which one they ended up. They ended up using this one, and here they've also included the Gaussian fits.
So, how are you extracting the limit at 70? Say at 70 GeV.
At 70 GeV, I'm making sure that I take a signal.
Yeah.
I extract all of these data points, put them into Mathematica, take my signal after it's gone through the detector, and then look at if it's inside this peak region. I make sure that it doesn't violate the statistical error of the difference between standard model and observed value at 2 sigma, if it lies in that region. And if it's outside of it, then it's just the statistical error on the absolute measurement of the data.
But adding in quadrature all the contributions, how are you weighting the different points in the width?
So the points that we see here, so these stop at 70 GeV, roughly, and that's where they started their Gaussian fit. So they claim that the fit only applies from, where was it here? The width, the Gaussians only kick in at about 70 GeV. And so the constraint comes in from contributions made to that Gaussian. And that's the only thing that I've plotted over there. But if you're over here, then it's just Poisson error.
Right, but it's a lot of different, it's Poisson over a lot of different bits. I just have trouble understanding how it can be so much weaker there than...
It's hazy in this intermediate region, but if you're out here, then Poisson error is a reasonable way to go about it. If you're in here, it's reasonable to look at how much you contribute to the Gaussian compared to what they've extracted. And if you're in here, then I would say it's a more complicated issue. But the only points that I've actually considered as benchmark values for any of the plots or for any of the conclusions were based on things that live squarely inside that hump.
Well, I think another way of putting it is that if I understand you right, is that you're being very optimistic for the 70 GeV case because you're only limiting it by how much it leaks into that pump, which if you look at 70 GeV, that's like throwing away, not using the constraint from half the data, mm-hmm. Right?
It turned out actually that the constraint coming from the bump, because I looked at every point individually, and it turned out that in this region, the reason I didn't plot it on the figure is that you don't have a good background model in this case. So I figured, all right, fine. Let's just look at what happens when you're out here. And it turns out that for points that live in this region, you actually get a much stronger constraint from what's allowed to live under this hump than from what's coming on the left side. And that by the time that you've saturated the uncertainty from what's living under the Gaussians, you're still safe from what's on the left-hand side because your background's growing exponentially. And so
I don't know exactly what you mean by Poisson errors if you don't have
actually
it.
Let's continue
okay.
The rest of these.
No, I just mean that you've got the square root of each bin and you make sure that it's not exceeding 2 times the square root of the number of events in each bin on the left-hand side of that Gaussian. And so if I pick a point here,
but if it exceeded that in every bin, then that would be a lot more than a 2 sigma significance.
That's true.
If you had some kind of a background model. Okay. if you didn't have a background model, then even if it was three times that in every bin, if you had no background model at all, even empirical, then you'd have no limit.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
So it seems like the limit's either much stronger or much weaker than you quote.
Yeah, in this case, right. I mean, because it's a trickier question, the only reason, that's why for every plot that I made, I only looked at masses that were bigger than that. The experimental situation gets murkier and murkier the smaller the mass is. And, I mean, even the Kaplan and Schwartz thing gives you a constraint that's not clear in that region.
All right. Anybody else have questions?
Well, we can continue discussion offline.